A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's urgent in that specific way only a move can be. He and his wife just switched apartments, did half the lifting themselves, and he tweaked his back on a cardboard box, woke up with lumbar pain. It's not going away. One, he had gallbladder surgery years ago and has bile reflux gastritis, so NSAI SIDS are off the table. What painkillers can he actually take that won't shred his stomach? 2. And this is the one I think is keeping him up at night. His mom has had back pain for decades, started with one summer working in the New York hotel. How does an acute back injury become chronic? And what can he do right now to make sure this doesn't become his story?
The second question is the one that matters most, and I'm glad he's asking it now rather than 6 months from now. But let's start with the immediate problem, because the man is in pain and surrounded by boxes. The pharmacology here is genuinely interesting. Here's why NSAIDs are specifically dangerous for someone with bile reflux gastritis. Your stomach lining has a protective mucus barrier. That barrier is maintained by prostaglandins, which are produced by an enzyme called COX-1. NSAIDs, ibuprofen, naproxen, diclofenac, they inhibit COX-1. They strip that protective layer. Now, bile reflux gastritis is already a condition where alkaline bile salts have compromised the mucosal barrier from the other direction, so you've got two separate insults hitting the same defense system. Adding an NSAID is like throwing gasoline on a fire that's already smoldering.
The stomach is already dealing with bile that shouldn't be there, and NSAIDs would essentially pull the remaining security guards off duty.
That's exactly the image, and the result can be erosions, bleeding, ulceration, not theoretical risks. I've seen it in practice. When I was still seeing patients, I had a woman come in with a GI bleed from taking ibuprofen for 3 days on top of undiagnosed bile reflux. She thought she was being cautious because she took it with food. Taking it with food doesn't fix the COX-1 problem.
What does Daniel actually reach for? Because he's in the middle of unboxing, he can't just lie on the floor and meditate his way through it.
First line is acetaminophen, paracetamol, depending on where you live. Here's what matters. It works centrally, in the brain and spinal cord, not peripherally at the site of inflammation. It spares the GI tract entirely because it doesn't touch COX-1 or COX-2. The trade-off is that it's an analgesic, not an anti-inflammatory. For back pain that has a mechanical and inflammatory component, which his does, because he's got muscle strain and probably some ligament stress, it's going to be less effective than ibuprofen would be. That's just the reality. The research bears this out. A Cochrane review found acetaminophen is not significantly better than placebo for acute low back pain in terms of pain reduction. But it's what we've got, and for many people, it takes the edge off enough to function.
That's a grim Cochrane finding. Not significantly better than placebo is not what you want to hear when you can't take the thing that actually works.
But here's the nuance. The dosing matters enormously. For an adult, the maximum safe dose is 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams per day. Given that Daniel's dealing with a stress system, moving is physically exhausting, he's probably not eating well, maybe not hydrating properly, I'd cap it at 3,000 milligrams. That's 1,000 milligrams every 6 hours, or 650 every 4 hours if he wants more consistent coverage. And he needs to actually take it on schedule, not wait until the pain is screaming. Acetaminophen works better when you stay ahead of the pain curve.
Time doses, not reactive. What about topical options? Because that seems like a way to bypass the stomach entirely.
This is where it gets good. Topical diclofenac gel, brand name Voltaren, available over the counter in a lot of countries now, is absorbed locally through the skin. It reaches therapeutic concentrations in the superficial tissues and underlying muscle with systemic absorption that's only about 5 to 10% of what you get from an oral dose. For lumbar back pain, if he applies it generously to the affected area 3 or 4 times a day, he's getting anti-inflammatory action right where he needs it with minimal GI exposure. The plasma levels are so low that the COX-1 inhibition in the stomach is negligible for most people.
He gets the anti-inflammatory mechanism that acetaminophen lacks, but without the stomach hit.
There's a caveat. The lumbar spine is deep. Topical diclofenac penetrates soft tissue well, but it's not reaching the intervertebral discs or deep spinal structures. For a muscle strain or ligament sprain, which is almost certainly what Daniel has, it's appropriate. If he had a herniated disc with nerve root compression, it wouldn't do much. But his presentation, woke up the next day with localized lumbar pain after a lifting injury, no mention of sciatica or radiating leg pain. That's mechanical low back pain. Topical diclofenac is a legitimate tool here.
There's another option you mentioned when we were talking before. Those lidocaine patches.
Lidocaine patches, 4% or 5%, applied directly to the painful area. Lidocaine is a sodium channel blocker. It literally stops nerves from firing pain signals. It doesn't reduce inflammation at all. It just interrupts the signal. The patches provide temporary relief for about 12 hours, and they have essentially zero systemic absorption. The downside is they're more expensive than the gel, and some people find the adhesive irritating. But from a GI safety standpoint, they're pristine. Nothing touches the stomach.
We've got a three-layer approach forming here. Oral acetaminophen on a schedule, topical diclofenac gel to the lumbar area, and lidocaine patches as a potential add-on. What about muscle relaxants? Because back spasms are a special kind of misery.
Cyclobenzaprine, brand name, Flexeril, or methocarbamol, which is Robaxin. These are sometimes prescribed for acute back spasms, and they don't interact with the GI tract the way NSAIDs do. The evidence for their efficacy is modest. We're talking maybe a 20 to 30% improvement in pain scores over placebo in the first week, and they cause significant sedation. For someone who's trying to unbox an apartment and function during the day, cyclobenzaprine in particular can be pretty impairing. But as a short-term option for nighttime, when the pain is keeping him awake and the sedation might actually be helpful, it's worth discussing with his doctor. 3 to 7 days max. Not a long-term solution.
The sedation is a bug during the day, but potentially a feature at night.
And sleep is a real factor here. Poor sleep amplifies pain perception. There's a bidirectional relationship between sleep disruption and pain sensitization. If he can get 1 or 2 nights of decent sleep with a muscle relaxant on board, that alone might help break the pain cycle enough to make the daytime more manageable.
You haven't mentioned heat yet, and I know you're a heat over ice evangelist.
For acute lumbar muscle strain, heat therapy is one of the most underrated interventions. A heating pad or warm pack applied for 15 to 20 minutes several times a day does 3 things. 1. It increases blood flow to the area, which helps clear inflammatory byproducts. 2. It reduces muscle spasm directly. Heat relaxes muscle fibers. 3. And this is the neuroscience part I find elegant. It activates thermoreceptors in the skin that send signals to the spinal cord that essentially compete with and inhibit pain signals. It's called gate control theory. Warmth closes the gate on pain, and it's zero risk. He could do it while sitting on a box, while lying on the floor, while taking a break. There's no downside.
To summarize the immediate plan before we get to the bigger question, acetaminophen 1,000 milligrams every 6 hours, max 3,000 per day. Topical diclofenac gel to the lumbar area 3 or 4 times daily. Heat therapy for 15 to 20 minutes at a time. Consider lidocaine patches if the gel isn't enough, and talk to the doctor about a short course of muscle relaxants for nighttime. That's the bridge to get him through the next few days until his appointment.
That's the bridge. And I want to emphasize, he said he's booking a doctor's appointment next week. That's the right call. Everything we're describing is for the interim. He should run all of this past his physician, especially given his surgical history. Bile reflux gastritis isn't just a casual footnote. It means his GI system has a known vulnerability, and any new medication, even topical, should be discussed with someone who has his full chart.
We've figured out what he can take for the pain. But the bigger question, the one that's probably got him staring at the ceiling at night, is whether this pain is going to stick around. Let's talk about the acute to chronic transition.
This is where the science has flipped in the last decade. The old model was rest until it feels better. Lie down, don't move, let it heal. The current evidence-based model, and this is reflected in the NHS guidelines, the Lancet series on low back pain, the American College of Physicians recommendations, is the opposite. Prolonged bed rest is not just unhelpful, it's a risk factor for chronicity.
How strong is that evidence? Because don't rest is counterintuitive enough that people need to hear the numbers.
Patients who resume normal activity within the first week have about a 25 to 30% lower risk of developing chronic pain at 6 months compared to those who rest for more than 2 days. That's from the Lancet series on low back pain. The mechanism is multifactorial. When you immobilize your spine, the paraspinal muscles begin to atrophy within days. The small stabilizing muscles, the multifidus, the transversus abdominis, they're the first to shut down. Your joints stiffen. Your brain starts to associate movement with threat. And that last part is the key to the whole chronic pain puzzle.
The danger isn't just physical deconditioning. It's that the brain rewires itself to expect pain.
This is central sensitization. Here's how it works. In the acute phase, you have actual tissue injury. Muscle fibers are torn, there's inflammation, nociceptors are firing. That's real. That's appropriate pain signaling. In a normal healing trajectory, the tissue repairs over 4 to 6 weeks. The inflammation resolves and the pain signals stop. But in some people, about 5 to 10% of acute low back pain cases, the nervous system doesn't stand down. The spinal cord and brain become hypersensitive. They amplify signals that would normally be subthreshold. A movement that should feel neutral gets interpreted as painful. The brain has learned to expect pain, and it keeps generating that expectation even after the original injury is healed.
The pain is real, but it's no longer a reliable signal of tissue damage.
And this is where the psychological component becomes inseparable from the physiological. The strongest predictor of whether acute back pain becomes chronic is fear, avoidance behavior. If you stop moving because you're afraid of pain, your muscles weaken, your joints stiffen, your confidence erodes, and your brain reinforces the pain equals movement association. It's a self-perpetuating loop. The pain leads to fear, fear leads to avoidance, avoidance leads to deconditioning, deconditioning leads to more pain. Breaking that loop early is the entire game.
Daniel's mom was onto something when she said you need to keep treating it even after the pain resolves. She just might have meant a different kind of treatment than continuing painkillers.
That's the crucial distinction. Keep treating it doesn't mean stay on medication indefinitely. It means continue graded activity, continue strengthening exercises, continue movement patterns that reinforce normal biomechanics, continue building resilience. The concept in the literature is motor control retraining. You're teaching the deep spinal stabilizers, the transversus abdominis, the multifidus, to activate properly and automatically. These muscles don't fire because you consciously tell them to. They're reflexive stabilizers. After an injury, that reflex gets inhibited, and you have to retrain it.
What does that actually look like for someone who's still in the middle of unboxing and can't exactly start a Pilates regimen?
Right now, today, there are specific things he can do. First, the 20-minute rule. Don't sit or stand in one position for more than 20 minutes. Alternate between sitting, standing, and walking. Set a timer if he has to. Prolonged static loading is worse for an injured back than controlled movement. Second, when he's lifting boxes, and I know he still has boxes to move, use a hip hinge pattern. That means stick your butt out, keep your back straight, bend at the hips, not at the waist. The power comes from the glutes and hamstrings, not the lumbar spine. Third, avoid twisting while carrying. Turn with your feet, not your torso. Torque on a loaded spine is a recipe for disc injury. Fourth, sleep on your side with a pillow between your knees. That maintains neutral spine alignment and prevents the pelvis from rotating forward, which puts stress on the lumbar region.
The hip hinge thing. I feel like most people think they're doing it until they actually see themselves on video. The amount of lumbar flexion people use when they think they're lifting properly is alarming.
It's universal. We're a species that forgot how to hinge. The good news is it's trainable. And for Daniel specifically, once the acute pain starts to subside, typically within 1 to 2 weeks for a first episode like this, he should begin a graded exercise program focused on core stabilization. Planks, bird dogs, dead bugs. These are low-load exercises that teach the deep stabilizers to fire without putting shear forces on the spine. The evidence says you need to continue this for at least 8 to 12 weeks after pain resolution to retrain motor patterns and prevent recurrence.
The window where people typically stop caring, once the pain is gone, is actually the window where the prevention work needs to happen.
That's the exact trap. Pain goes away, you go back to normal life, the underlying motor control deficits are still there, and 6 months later you bend over to pick up a sock and your back goes out again. the recurrence rate for low back pain is high. One study found that about a third of people have a recurrence within a year. The goal of the rehab phase isn't just to feel better now. It's to make your spine resilient enough that the next cardboard box doesn't take you out.
Let me ask you something about the psychology here. Daniel mentioned his mom's back pain started with one summer working in a hotel in New York. That was presumably decades ago, and she's still dealing with it. He's got to be looking at that and thinking, is that my future?
That's the fear. And it's a rational fear. There is a familial component to chronic pain, partly genetic, partly learned. If you grow up watching a parent catastrophize back pain, avoid activity, and talk about their back as fragile or damaged, you internalize those beliefs. When your own back hurts, those beliefs activate. But here's the thing, it's not destiny. The intergenerational transmission of chronic pain is modifiable. The fact that Daniel is asking this question now, in the acute phase, means he's already ahead of the curve. He's not passively accepting that this is his fate. He's looking for evidence-based strategies to change the trajectory.
The evidence says the trajectory is changeable.
The key is to not catastrophize the pain. Pain does not equal damage, especially in the subacute phase after the first few days. The nervous system can be sensitized without ongoing tissue injury. If you interpret every twinge as proof that your spine is falling apart, you reinforce the fear avoidance loop. The alternative is to stay active within pain tolerance, stay confident, and trust the healing process. That's not woo-woo positivity. That's pain neuroscience education, and it has measurable effects on outcomes.
There's something almost paradoxical about it. The people who are most vigilant about protecting their backs, avoiding movement, bracing, guarding, are often the ones who end up with the worst long-term outcomes.
It's the paradox of chronic pain. The protective behaviors become the pathology. I saw this in pediatric medicine too, actually. Kids with chronic abdominal pain whose parents kept them home from school and let them avoid activities, they got worse, not better. The kids whose parents acknowledged the pain but maintained normal routines and expectations, they improved. The same principle applies to backs.
If you're Daniel, and you're listening to this while sitting on a moving box with a heating pad on your lumbar spine, what's the concrete takeaway for the next few weeks?
Phase 1. Right now, during the acute pain, acetaminophen on schedule, topical diclofenac gel, heat therapy, the 20-minute movement rule, hip hinge for all lifts, side sleeping with a pillow between the knees, no prolonged sitting, no bed rest. Keep moving gently. Walking is excellent. Phase 2, once the sharp pain starts to ease, probably in a week or two, begin graded core stabilization exercises. Planks, bird dogs, dead bugs. Start with short holds, progress gradually. Continue for at least 8 to 12 weeks after the pain is fully resolved. Phase 3, long term, maintain a basic core and hip strength routine indefinitely. Your spine is a load-bearing structure. It needs maintenance like anything else.
The psychological piece. Don't let this one injury become the story you tell yourself about your body.
Your mom's story is not your story. You get to write a different one, and the evidence supports that it's possible.
I want to flag one thing before we wrap up the clinical part. You mentioned red flags earlier. When does this stop being a wait-and-see situation and become an emergency?
So, for anyone listening with back pain, there are a few red flags that warrant immediate medical attention, not a next week appointment. Cauda equina syndrome. That's compression of the nerve roots at the bottom of the spinal cord. It presents with loss of bladder or bowel control, numbness in the saddle area, the inner thighs and groin, and progressive weakness in the legs. That's a surgical emergency. Also, if the pain is accompanied by unexplained fever, that could indicate an infection. If there's progressive motor weakness, your foot is dropping, you can't push off when walking. That needs urgent evaluation. Daniel's presentation. Localized mechanical low back pain without radicular symptoms, no neurological deficits, is low risk and appropriate for conservative management.
He's in the reassuring majority.
About 90% of acute low back pain is nonspecific and mechanical. It resolves with time and appropriate management. The odds are in his favor.
To pull it all together for Daniel, the immediate pain plan is acetaminophen plus topical diclofenac plus heat. The movement protocol is the 20-minute rule, hip hinge, no twisting, side sleeping. The long-term prevention is core stabilization for 8 to 12 weeks after pain resolution. And the psychological strategy is to not catastrophize, stay active, and recognize that pain in the subacute phase is more about nervous system sensitivity than ongoing damage.
That's the summary. And I'll add one thing I haven't said yet. He mentioned they did this move themselves because the last one was too expensive. Moving is one of the most physically demanding things a person can do, and we tend to underestimate it because it's not a sport, it's just life. But the combination of heavy lifting, repetitive bending, sleep disruption, stress, poor nutrition during the chaos, it's a perfect storm for injury. He shouldn't blame himself for mishandling one cardboard box. The box was the straw that broke the camel's back, but the camel was already carrying a lot.
That's a fair point. The injury wasn't just the one bad lift. It was the cumulative load of an entire move.
That's actually relevant to prevention too. Next time, and there will be a next time, people move. He might consider pacing differently, spread the lifting over more days. Hire help for the heavy stuff even if the full-service movers are too expensive. The cost of a chronic back problem dwarfs whatever you save on moving labor.
Which brings us to the open question I want to leave listeners with. We've got strong evidence that staying active is better than resting for back pain. The NHS guidelines say it. The Lancet series says it. The American College of Physicians says it. And yet, if you ask the average person on the street what to do for a sore back, they'll tell you to lie down and rest. The rest until it hurts less. Advice is still pervasive. What would it take to shift that cultural narrative? How do we design public health messaging that actually changes behavior around back pain?
I think part of the problem is that stay active sounds like advice for people who aren't really in pain. It sounds dismissive. The messaging needs to convey that movement is treatment, not just tolerance. It's not grin and bear it. It's this is how you heal. That's a fundamentally different frame.
The fear piece is real. If your back hurts when you move, moving feels like self-harm. Overcoming that instinct requires trust in the evidence, and most people don't read The Lancet.
Which is why podcasts like this exist, I suppose. To translate the evidence into something people can actually use when they're sitting on a moving box at 11 at night with a heating pad and a lot of anxiety.
If you're in the middle of a move and your back is hurting, try the acetaminophen plus topical gel plus heat protocol tonight. And if you've had a similar experience, back pain during a life transition, a move, a new job, a new baby, share your story with us. We might do a follow-up on the emotional toll of physical setbacks during major life changes. There's something about the timing of an injury that makes it worse than the injury itself. Your body fails you right when you need it most, and that can mess with your head.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, researchers studying the lava tube caves of Mauritius discovered a species of blind cave shrimp whose hemolymph contains hemocyanin with an unusually high copper content, nearly double that of its surface. Likely an adaptation to the low oxygen environment of the subterranean pools.
I don't know what to do with that information.
Double the copper in a cave shrimp. Thank you, Hilbert.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review. It helps other people with sore backs find us. We'll be back next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.